Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On a Wednesday, it is January 14th. Friends, welcome, welcome, welcome on into the program. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt.
For decades, politicians have talked about family values, but now a new report from the Heritage Foundation says the American family isn't just changing, but they claim it's in crisis. Marriage is down, birth rates are falling. The U.S. is now below its replacement rate when we talk about birth rates. Meanwhile, young adults are waiting longer to partner and to have kids, and some are opting out altogether. This report argues that this isn't just a personal choice problem, but a national emergency. And they say that government should step in to restore marriage, encourage childbirth, and reorder how Americans form families. And so we're going to talk about this. We're asking, is the American family really at a crossroads? And if so, who gets to choose the road forward? We have a couple of really smart guests with differing viewpoints who will help us explore this topic. And we would love to hear from you, our listeners. Our questions of the day are, why are Americans having fewer children? And what do you think could change that? The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on Facebook or YouTube, put your comments in the chat.
Yeah, those questions again. Why are Americans having fewer children? And what do you think could change that? And I'll note, this is not just happening in America. It's happening in almost every developed country around the world. So if your prescription is America specific, if your analysis is America specific, defend that, right? Because it's not just happening here. Why are Americans having fewer children? What do you think could change that? 888-477-9499, email studio2@whyy.org.
Trio of news stories, Avi Wolfman Arendt.
Let's dive in. Several University of Pennsylvania faculty and student groups are joining the university as it resists attempts by the federal government to obtain information about Jewish students and staff. Now, this conflict dates back to July. The Equal Employment Opportunity Commission subpoenaed Penn asking for info, on workplace anti-Semitism complaints and membership lists for various Jewish-related campus groups. That's according to the Daily Pennsylvanian. The government says that it's doing this as part of its broader effort to root out anti-Semitism on college campuses, but the university has not complied. And this week, several groups representing staff and students at Penn filed a motion to become co-defendants in this case. They say they are disturbed by the government's efforts to get personal information on Jewish campus members. Professor Stephen Weitzman, a member of Penn's Task Force on Anti-Semitism, told The Guardian that this action, quote, instills a sense of vulnerability among Jews. He continued, quote, part of what sets off alarm bells for people like me is a history of people using Jewish lists against Jews.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of these groups, they're like, hey, we recognize that there's this effort to root out anti-Semitism, but they want to feel supported, not threatened. And you can understand that, right? Because this is also a legal issue. And the ACLU says that these subpoenas from the EEOC would require that Penn give personal phone numbers, people's personal emails, their home addresses. And this kind of goes against established law. I mean, during the civil rights era, people would ask for NAACP lists, and they fought to make sure that those lists were not disclosed. Why? Because it could have a chilling effect on whether or not people join organizations that are religious or that could become political targets. And so they want to protect the members of these groups. And, you know, it may feel very triggering to people in the Jewish community who go back, you know, years and years. They remember the Holocaust. They remember some of the attacks against Jews. And so, you know, folks are drawing that line in the sand because they don't trust what could happen in the future with this information.
Yeah, and I am curious for the perspective of all of the donors, many of them Jewish, who essentially organized and orchestrated an administrative coup at Penn a couple years back, got the president fired.
Yeah,
Made the board president step down. They said they were doing that because they were worried about anti-Semitism at Penn. Here you have a lot of Jewish campus members saying they don't feel safe because of this request. I haven't heard, maybe they've said something, I haven't heard anything from that group of donors about these requests. Mark Rowan being the most significant of those donors. If they've said something, I haven't seen it, but I'd be curious why they haven't said anything about this.
Yeah, interesting for sure. We're going to go over to New Jersey because it's getting a little greasy over there. The owner of the company behind Taylor Ham, yes, the pork roll, is under fire amid racy new allegations in a growing list of lawsuits. This latest suit, according to NJ.com, was filed by an executive who worked at Taylor for 44 years. He alleges that the company has dirty food production areas, that the owner launched a campaign to force out highly paid workers, and that she sent a risque photo of herself in lingerie and threatened to fire him if he didn't lie in bed with her during a meeting at her home. Now, the claims include sexual harassment, illegal wiretapping of workers, wrongful termination, among other allegations. And this marks the seventh lawsuit against Ann Cumbler, the president of the Trenton-based Taylor Provisions. Cumbler is the widow of both Tony and George Cumbler, brothers and heirs to the Taylor Provisions legacy. Tony and George died in 2020 and 2022, respectively. And as I mentioned, this is a seventh suit. Six other suits have been brought by former employees or their representatives since August of 2024. So a lot of some stuff going on over there at Taylor Provisions is pork rolls, you know. Known for that. So
yeah, well, the big division in New Jersey is whether you call it a Taylor ham or pork roll. If these allegations are correct, I think maybe I'll go with pork roll from now on, because these are some really disturbing allegations. Seven lawsuits against Ann Cumbler, who's now the president of Taylor Provisions,
and she's only been president since 2022.
For a short time.
And, so that's a lot going on.
The latest lawsuit is from an employee who's like a lifer at the company, been there for over 40 years. Doesn't seem like the type of person who would be like trying to damage Taylor's reputation. Now, of course, you got to prove all the stuff, court of law, et cetera, et cetera. But it certainly looks like a mess of someone's making. So we'll see what happens.
Yep.
Final story here. According to the Philadelphia Inquirer, the Sixers and Comcast are planning to demolish about half a block of buildings across the street from the Fashion District on Market East. The idea here is to turn this lot, once demolished, into a pop-up space in time for the summer, so that during the semi-quincentennial celebrations and the World Cup, it could be used for some sort of pop-up thing or things. Now, what's going to happen after that, we really don't know, and it's just part of the broader uncertainty swirling around this historic stretch of Philadelphia. The Sixers and Comcast purchased this chunk of buildings on Market East last year, shortly after the Sixers abandoned their plans to build an arena in the same neighborhood. You know, when they ditched that arena plan, the Sixers said, we're still committed to Market East. We're going to work with Comcast to do something. So now we're starting to see some momentum. But it's a small bit of momentum, and we still don't know what the long-term vision is here for what's soon seemingly going to become another demolished lot on this stretch where there are already a couple of surface parking lots.
Yeah. You know, great story by the Inky here. They had a whole video and everything. And you know what? I hadn't realized how many times there had been promises made to change and revitalize Market East. I mean, I didn't realize there had been a promised Disney indoor theme park.
Yeah, the Disney Hole. Yeah.
I didn't even know that. But I mean, you know, the Disney Hole. And then that was abandoned. And now there's a parking lot there. And, you know, then, you know, we all suffered the trauma of the whole Sixers arena, people fighting about that. And then they pulled out last minute. But what concerns me is the vision is really unclear at this point. I truly wonder, you know, what I can see what excites people about Market East, but then there's something there that scares them away.
Yeah.
And it causes them to abandon plans. And so I just hope that we don't end up with a bunch of weeds in this vacant lot.
Yeah, of course. Or even another parking lot. That would be a very disappointing outcome.
Because the parking lots, I mean, we like parking, but that won't revitalize Market East.
No, it certainly won't. We don't know what's going to happen here. I don't know if demolition is the right move. What also concerns me a little bit here is that there's supposed to be this broader group that's working on a plan for Market East. And it seems like this is happening kind of independent of that or before that group has really done its work or made its recommendations. So hopefully at some point people sync up here, because you would imagine it's going to take some sort of, you know, organized, galvanized effort to really bring back this stretch.
And the mayor says it's going to get done. So we shall see.
It's like our favorite phrase.
I know. We say that a lot.
We shall see.
We'll be
Renaissance watching. Renaissance on Market East. Well, Renaissance means rebirth.
Mm-hmm.
Talking about birth today on
the show.
America's birth rates are falling. Should the government step in and try to change that? We want your opinions. 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org.
Welcome back to Studio 2 here on WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Fewer Americans are having kids. Fewer are also getting married. While the decline in birth rates is a global phenomenon, government officials in the U.S. and others have voiced concern because here in America, it is indeed below replacement levels. The Trump administration has talked about falling fertility and floated several ideas to reverse it, such as baby bonuses to persuade women to have more kids.
Some of the ideas have come from the conservative think tank, the Heritage Foundation. They have a new report out, Saving America by Saving the Family, which urges the government to incentivize marriage and children. Its authors call for a culture-wide Manhattan Project to restore the nuclear family and includes ideas like seed savings accounts for newlyweds, child tax credits for larger families, and marriage boot camp.
But can government programs actually boost the birth rate? And how concerned should we be about the decline in fertility and marriage? Well, we have two guests to talk about all of this. Jennifer Shuba is a demographer and the president and CEO of the Population Reference Bureau. Jennifer, welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you. Nice to be with all of you.
And Delano Squires is director of the Richard and Helen DeVos Center for Human Flourishing at the Heritage Foundation. He's also an author on this new report. Delano, welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you for having me.
And for you, our listeners at home, on the road, or elsewhere, our questions of the day are this: why are Americans having fewer children, and what do you think could change that? The number to call to participate is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on Facebook or YouTube, put your comments in the chat.
Before we get into the bigger conversation about what to do, I think we have to establish first, why is the birth rate declining in this country? And then what are the downsides of a declining birth rate? So, Delano, I'll start with you. Why do you think the birth rate is falling in this country? Oh, I think you're on mute, or we can't hear you, Delano.
You can't hear me?
Oh, there you, you go. You're back. Hello.
Okay.
Here we go. Now, I'll ask you again. Why is the birth rate falling in this country?
I think it's a complex mix of social and policy factors, but I think ultimately cultural reasons are the reason why birth rates are declining. Part of this is as nations move from agricultural to industrial, you do tend to see birth rates decline. But I would argue that particularly in the last 60 years, what we've seen is that family has been cast as a drag, particularly on women and their careers. Children are talked about as a burden oftentimes. What we see in surveys is that many Americans think that you can have a flourishing life and a great life without having family. And the constant message, the constant drumbeat from the culture is that marriage and family are not particularly important. So I think what we've seen, again, over the last 60 years is just something that is happening in the West, and largely in many countries, not just the United States of America, where we just don't prioritize family in the way that we did. It's no longer seen as valuable, desirable, accessible, and particularly for the sake of our report, as necessary. Marriage is necessary as a foundation for the family. So again, a complex and complicated sort of dance between policy and culture. But for my money, I would say that the reasons are largely cultural.
And what's an example of that? What's something you would point to and you would say, this shows what's changed culturally that's led to this outcome, Delano?
Well, one of the things, particularly on the on the conservative side, particularly like pro-life conservatives, they would look at the messaging that says messages to young women that having a baby, particularly a baby that they're not ready for, is going to negatively impact their life. I would see a baby. I see a baby as a blessing. Obviously, I would prefer children to be born within the bonds of marriage. But when you say that children are a burden to your life goals and life dreams, it sends the signal that family is not particularly important and that the things that you do in the workplace are far more important than the things that you do in the family.
Jennifer, your thoughts on why the birth rate is declining here in America?
I think the first half of what Delano just said, we see that in evidence, certainly, that there really are shifts in terms of values, where people place their values. Do they see getting married and having children as necessary steps to lead a fulfilling life, or do they see them as maybe nice to haves? So a part of it, really, I would say we do see that those shift in values, not just here, but in other countries in the world. Because one thing for us to note is that this is actually really a global phenomenon. Two out of every three people on the planet live somewhere with this below replacement fertility rate. So it's not unique to American culture, but it's certainly also, as he said, a complex answer. And so there is an economic piece of this that we don't want to ignore. It's really hard as social scientists to be able to figure out which of these variables has the most power. Also, this is something that's new. So it's hard to know what exactly it is, but we certainly can't deny that it is much harder to buy a home today. It is we do see people struggling in terms of student loan debt and other economic constraints that are holding them back from having the number of children that they want. So at the same time that we want to recognize there's been a value shift, we should also recognize that there are factors holding people back from having the number of children they desire. They might like to have more, we see in surveys, than they are having. And so that's a space where I think we can also have a conversation about what the policy options look like there.
By the way, Joanne Fisher says affordability of homes and childcare, paid parental leave, attention to ensuring a sustainable future. I want to bring in a caller. We have Lori from Norristown, Pennsylvania on the line. Lori, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
I was just going to say that I noticed a corresponding steep decline in religious practice in America as far as people who attend a worship service regularly. Or, even just belief in God, the percentage of what we call nuns, NONES, has increased crazily in the last couple decades. I don't know that the government should or really can do anything about that, but I do believe that religious practice is something that, as your first speaker said, influences people to see marriage and family as a priority, and as something important.
Yeah, thank you. That's Lori from Norristown, Pennsylvania. By the way, our questions are, why are Americans having fewer children, and what do you think could change that? The number, again, 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And so I wanted to ask you, Delano and Jennifer, like, what is at stake? So people say, I know in the report from the Heritage Foundation, it almost says we're at a crisis level, and it's almost like a sounding of the alarm. So explain, like, why we should be paying attention to this, and what is at stake if we don't change these trends? Delano, starting with you.
Sure, absolutely. I think to put it plainly, what's at stake is that the future of America will be far fewer Americans, right? So this is one of the things, to Jennifer's point, that every country is having to deal with the issue of depopulation. And people will get into sort of the economic ramifications of that. How do you sustain social security programs if you have fewer people paying into them? I think those are important. For me, part of the way I come at this is looking at the family as a social good. And what is at stake when you have fewer people being born, fewer babies being born, and particularly fewer babies being born within the context of marriage? In 1965, about 7% of American children were born to unmarried parents. Today, it's about 40%. So that means that the birth rate has declined even as the non-marital birth rate has gone up. And what that means is what's at stake is that the future of how we think about family will completely change. You're going to have more people, not only who don't have siblings, who don't have first cousins. You're going to have more adults who don't know the joy of becoming a grandparent. You're going to have more kids whose definitions and understandings of the family home, the family car, the family vacation, a family business, and even a family reunion will be drastically different, because how we come to define and think about family is going to be different. So while there are economic and political ramifications, I tend to focus more so on the social and cultural ramifications. And that's one of the things that we are trying to address in this report.
Yeah. And so, Jennifer, I mean, for a long time, we were talking about overpopulation. And now all of a sudden there's the talk that we're at a crisis level when it comes to underpopulation. So is there a crisis? Explain to me why what's at stake here?
I like the way you set that up, because it always reminds me of Goldilocks, right? There's like, to the porridge is too hot, the porridge is too cold. Maybe it's never just
right.
Never
just right, yeah.
That's right. And I think that is the question. I'm a scholar of the history of this as well. And so if you're really zooming out, we do see that nobody's ever terribly happy with what the population is. We create this different groups, I will say, create an ideal. They can sit anywhere on the political or ideological spectrum, and they have their own ideal. And we kind of use these policies to chase that ideal. Then somebody else comes into power and they have a different ideal. And then we work our policies around that. It is not really the case that there is an ideal population in terms of number of children. Is it 2.1 or 2.0 or 3 or 1? It is not necessarily the case that we have an ideal age structure. So we talk about, if you visualize the ages of a population, and we call that a population pyramid or a tree. When you had lots of babies born per woman, it looked like a pyramid. If you have very few, then it could look inverted. And so this would be, what's the proportion of working age population to older people? All of that. There's not necessarily an ideal. It is just, what choices does it force you to make about other parts in your society? So what we're in right now, I suppose you could have sound an alarm of crisis to say that if you don't change anything else about your society and you just keep everything going like it is, the population is going to be changing no matter what. And your structures and systems become increasingly divorced from that reality, which could lead to things like a collapse in our social security system, a care crisis, economic change. It could lead to us taking rights away from people out of panic. So they're invoking crisis language is meant to get us to spur into action. And it happens it's not unique to births. I would say where I want to always point our attention is in thinking about, what do we have control over to change and what do we not? What are we doing to adapt to reality versus how do we use markers of successes only shifting those births? And so there's so much more that we could talk about with how do we have these resilient societies that may acknowledge that you're not going to actually see a raise in births, but you could still have this resilience and thrive.
Let me bring in another caller now. This is Leah from Marlton, New Jersey, on line 2, I believe. Leah, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Yes, I actually have a background in marriage and family therapy, and I went to Liberty University, which is associated with Heritage Foundation. I just wanted to say that I think that more funding towards social programs, such as universal health care, subsidized or free child care, paid parental leave, those are very important. So many people want to have children, but they don't feel like it's a safe society to do that. They don't believe that they're going to be supported by their community, by the government. If the government wants this to happen, they need to invest in it and not just expect it to happen. I'm also very deeply troubled by referencing the Heritage Foundation. They are a Christian nationalist organization. They want to remove women or push them from the workforce and force them into homes in heterosexual relationships, marriages, without any sort of resource for leaving those marriages, getting rid of no-fault divorce. They want to push heterosexual marriage as the only way to get married, no gay marriage, no gay adoption. So honestly, I think that we can address an issue of low population, but not through what they will propose. It's deeply, deeply troubling. I am a former Christian nationalist. Yeah. It's deeply troubling. Also, immigration.
Thank you, Leah. We just have to move the conversation along.
Yeah,
and I appreciate
thank you, Leah.
That. So I want to give Delano a chance to respond there. So, look, Leah's saying there are things we can do with government support, but is worried that what your organization wants to do is essentially cap the intellectual career aspirations of women to return to this sort of pre-feminist social structure. Is that a fair, you know, appraisal of what the Heritage Foundation wants to do?
Absolutely not. I mean, I appreciate Leah's comments, and I understand that this topic is a sensitive one for many. I do believe, and one of the previous callers talked about the role of the decline in religion and religiosity. I do think that that is one of the issues. But I find it interesting, again, and this goes back to my first point, about how we as a culture talk about the family. So even the notion that a woman may want to stay home oftentimes is derided and looked down upon. And one of the ways I put it is that our nation, our culture, upholds any woman who dedicates herself to running a large, complex organization, unless it's her home. And we love women who dedicate themselves to the next generation of young people, unless it's their own children. So in this way, the stated ideals of feminism in terms of giving women choice have never really been the case. There's been a thumb on the scale, and I heard it in the caller's remarks, where the notion that some women may choose to stay at home, particularly when their children are young, to take care of them, is frowned upon and seen as regressive. So this is one of the cultural issues that we're having to fight. I think that is a mischaracterization of what we are saying. The points about heterosexual marriage, I'll say this: the government has an interest in marriage to the extent that relationships between adults produce children. To date, there's only one relationship pairing between adults that can produce children. And every single person, all of us involved in this conversation, every child that's born in this country, is the living embodiment of exactly one man and one woman. So our interest in talking about adult relationships is in the context of what is best for children. And I think part of what we're trying to do with this report is turn the cultural conversation about the family from what adults desire to what children have a right to. So when we talk about rights as it relates in the home, every right comes with a corresponding obligation, and children have a right to the affection, protection, and direction of the man and woman who created them. I don't think adults have rights to children that they have not created.
Wait, I just want to make sure I understand. You're saying that a homosexual couple, they can produce a child through all sorts of different means, and they can adopt a child. So I'm just trying to understand the point there. You're saying that would not be in the government's interest because ...
I'm saying that whether it's two men or two women cannot create a child naturally. They can use reproductive technology to do so. Some may adopt children. Some may go the route of surrogacy. All of those things are downstream, particularly if you're talking about children who have already been born, are downstream from the relationship between one man and one woman. So what we're saying is that the government's interest really is in the protection of children, and those children come about from one type of adult relationship pairing. So we're not taking a position in this report on the status of Obergefell or other issues of that sort. But I think so much of the conversation around the family starts with, what do adults desire? What do we want? What makes us feel good? As opposed to what children need. And that's what I'm trying to get at with respect to her comments.
And so I think the question now becomes, is the government the right entity to sort of get involved in decisions around family, around whether people marry, around whether and how many children people have? And so, I want to get your take on that, Jennifer, before we invite Delano to sort of lay out the report's recommendations. So what are your thoughts about government being the entity, the force, to sort of change this trend that we're seeing?
Yeah, I was thinking about that with your comments, Delano. And, if we take out this particular report that we're here to talk about and just think broadly about, should bureaucrats be in the bedroom? I mean, we do see that if we accept that they should be in the bedroom, we have to then accept that no matter what their politics or ideology is, they should be in the bedroom. And so, that's the first question, which I actually, when we look around the world, we do see that governments looking at the body, the family, as spaces that they could politicize. And it always works out for some groups and never works out for other groups. And those groups just shift over time. It's back and forth like a game of ping pong. So it's the right question to ask to say, should they be in there at all? Because it's always going to be, if this vision comes to light now, then this vision might get knocked out later. And we'd have to just be equally okay with both sides of this. That's very tough to look at. So I would like to point us also to saying governments are not the only players out there, particularly if we take this point that we started our conversation with about culture and what role do culture and values play in for family formation. Government is not the best at setting culture. Sometimes they can, of course, put policies in place that lay the groundwork or smooth the path for this. But we've got, how do individual communities address these issues or think about building communities that, again, could be resilient no matter that population change? That doesn't have to mean a national government solution. How do we think about, in many other places in the world, different corporations have actually worked to set that corporate culture all the way into the family. I actually just had another book come out in November where I looked at Japan and how companies there had, in the post-war era, really tried to actually shape the family around certain sets of values and all the way down to, how many children would the ideal family have? And I'm not advocating that as a model, but I'm just saying we don't actually have to be so narrow-minded as to only think that the national government's the scene setter.
Yeah, and thank you for that, Jennifer. And Delano, I want to give you like a minute or two to sort of lay out why you think the government should be the entity to sort of help reverse this trend of declining birth rates.
Well, I would argue the government has been in the bedroom for the better part of 60 years. The advent of the welfare state, particularly in post-1965, it is actually exactly that. The government replaced particularly men as the primary provider for their homes, and particularly in low-income communities. So what we've seen is that the government can do a lot of damage to the home. It is an open question, and I think Jennifer and I would agree on this, on whether the same government that can deconstruct can actually rebuild. The argument that I'm making, that we're making in the report, is that the government has a limited role to play in that reconstruction process. And I'll give one quick example. There's nothing that would stop, let's say, the local government in Philadelphia from running ads across the city that say, in this town, we put marriage before carriage. Is that going to turn around the non-marital birth rate and make more people get married? No, but it sends a signal. It's a seed that can then be watered by some other institution. And it sends a signal that the government sees value in the formation of families that goes back to that old schoolyard rhyme. First comes love, then comes marriage, then comes baby in the baby carriage. What the government has been doing is saying, no, we will step in and be the provider in the home. And we've seen the results of that over the last 60 years.
And sort of on the flip side of this, we had a caller earlier, and we've got more lined up. We'll get to you soon. We had a caller earlier talk about expanding the social safety net as one potential solution to this, whether that has to do with childcare, healthcare, et cetera. But I will point out there are some like Nordic countries with very vast social safety nets that also have very low fertility rates, Denmark being one of them. TFR there is around 1.5, well below replacement. I suppose, Jennifer, with about a minute before the break, is there any evidence that expanding the social safety net does indeed encourage fertility?
No, and the examples that are usually cited, we can get it. They're temporary blips and not a sustained turnaround. But what I do think we could perhaps tee up for the second half is saying, well, maybe they don't increase the number of births, but maybe they do actually even strengthen the family or support families in more meaningful ways. And so there's plenty for us to talk about as long as we're not making our marker of success, whether or not that birth rate goes up, we're making it about well-being and support. I think there's spots we could talk about as well where in this Heritage report, we see there are some pieces straight out of the progressive playbook. So where can we talk about bringing people together on these issues?
Yeah, so just to sort of sum that up, though, don't expect, the tax credits or free childcare to trigger a baby boom. There's just not much evidence
No.
out there from other countries around the world that that has indeed happened. So something to keep in mind as we continue this conversation. 888-477-9499 is the number to call. The email is studio2@whyy.org. We're talking about America's falling fertility rate and what, if anything, should be done about it. Give us a call. This is Studio 2 on WHYY. And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. We're talking about America's declining birth rate and what can and should be done about it. With us today are Jennifer Shuba, President and CEO of the Population Reference Bureau, and Delano Squires, Director of the Richard and Helen DeVos Center for Human Flourishing at the Heritage Foundation.
And we want to hear from you this hour. Why do you think Americans are having fewer children? What do you think could change that? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org, YouTube, Facebook. How you doing? Drop a comment in the chat.
So we've been getting a lot of emails and comments. Chuck says, cost of living. Both parents need to work to support the same lifestyle their parents and grandparents had with just one member of the household working. Elaine says, the government must do the hard work of fixing child care and health care to allow couples or singles to consider creating or expanding a family, and fix immigration to allow working families to come and contribute to America. We want to bring in another caller. We have Rose from Pennsport on the line. Rose, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi. Yeah. So I'm a queer woman married to a woman, and we have a young child. And so I sort of dispute the idea that queer people are not involved in increasing the number of babies that exist in the United States. So that's one thing. But a huge part of the reason that I chose to have a child with my wife is that, like, we have an equitable distribution of labor in our home, which is not something that I have ever had with male partners, and it is not something that I see from many of the male partners of other mothers of young children that I know. So, you know, the idea that, like, culturally we need to be more open about children, we also need, as part of that cultural shift, to, like, distribute some of the responsibility for those children, especially because there isn't the economic possibility at this time to, like, be a one-income home. Like, yeah. That's not, as many commenters have pointed out, like, that's not possible right now. So as long as that's not possible, then childcare and home stuff needs to be equitably distributed, and it just isn't.
Yeah.
So it makes sense to me that, like, why would you want to have a child when you are working just like your spouse, and then all of the stuff that is related to that child falls on you because your spouse isn't going to pick up that slack.
Thank you. That's Rose from Pennsport.
I want to now direct that to you, Delano Squires, from the Heritage Foundation. I am curious because we have a lot of comments on that effect, like, the sort of, there's this disproportionate impact on women who are trying to work and raise children along with partners, whether their partners are male, female, whatever. And that is a big, you know, hurdle for people. Is there anything that you think culturally or governmentally can be done to ease that burden?
Well, that's a great sort of segue to some of the policies that we promote and put into the paper. So one of them, we talk about what we call the nest credit, right? So this is a credit that would be for newlyweds, but it would build on the existing Trump accounts that are about $1,000 at the birth of a child. This would be $2,500 at the birth of a child. And then when that child grows up into adulthood, if that adult now marries before the age of 30, because we're trying to consider issues around, you know, fertility and just what some of the data says there. If you have two people who do that, they would be eligible for, let's say, $38,000. That would be the distribution at the time that they get married, paid out over the course of, I believe, three or four years. That could go towards a down payment for a home or even for the cost of a wedding, to ease some of that cost burden. Because I do think it's, whether you're on the left or the right, whether you are a Mamdani Republican or a Trump Democrat, the issue of affordability is one that keeps coming up.
Yeah.
I will say, though, and I have to note this culturally, I do think a big part of this is because current generations believe that we have a right to a particular lifestyle. If you go back a few generations, families regularly had 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 children. My mom is the youngest of 10 kids. My dad is the second youngest of six. My grandparents had far fewer resources than I did. Their generation, generally speaking, did not make nearly as much money. You had more people in smaller homes, but I just think there was a different orientation towards the family than there is right now. And that's why you see, even as some couples have two incomes, the notion of DINKS, double income, no kids. These are people who have plenty of income, plenty of resources, but for whatever reason, just do not value children in the same way.
Let me ask you, though, about cultural shifts, because one thing you've brought up earlier is this idea that feminism or people, I suppose, who are exposed to those ideas feel as though a woman working is of sort of higher importance than being a mother. They don't equate those two things. But one cultural shift that you could also potentially try to encourage here to encourage people to have more children is to say, look, we acknowledge that the man and the woman in a heterosexual relationship are likely to work, to both need to work. And why don't we encourage men to take on more of the household duties? That's another way to potentially get toward the same end. Why not also try to encourage that cultural shift?
I think that's a great question. But let me put a few numbers on the table just to give a context of how much things have changed, right? So the median age for first marriage in 1980 was about 24 for a man and 22 for a woman. It's about 31 and 29, respectively. Across the West, this age has gone up. Far fewer people are married today, adults, than were before. So in many respects, the American marriage model has gone from early and often to less and later. That being said, it is undeniable that the average man today is far more involved in, if you want to call it, domestic responsibilities than his grandfather or great-grandfather. When you go to the Whole Foods and you see the 27-year-old guy with the baby Bjorn and the child strapped on his front, his granddad wasn't doing that. For my two of my first four children, I took the maximum amount of paid parental leave that was available for my job at the time. My story is not unique. So men are more involved. It's just our culture has this notion of that men and women are exactly the same. And what I would argue is that men and women are equal in dignity and worth, different in form and function. So we try to act as if there are no gender roles that are innate or according to our nature. I would fundamentally disagree with that position. Any man who has ever asked his wife to go out when there's a bump in the night would realize how quickly that everyone believes in gender roles. So I'm not saying that men should not do more in the home. I would argue men are doing certainly more than their predecessors, but the notion of sort of a flat androgynous equity within the home is not one that I think is realistic, and I don't even think that's what most women would want, to tell you the truth.
Also note that women are also doing more. I mean, just to pull back to the data point, so absolutely, data show men are doing more. They also show women are doing more. And so, I think about that, thought about it last night when I couldn't get my middle schoolers to bed, just how many more hours a day women are spending with their kids. Even women in high paying jobs are spending more time with their kids than stay at home moms would have been in the past, like my mom. So everybody's doing that more. Actually, does speak to your comment earlier, Delano, about intensive parenting and maybe even our expectations around that. Or actually, that's in the report, but this idea of this intensive parenting thing. But we do see this this inequity around the world with the number of hours that men or fathers spend with their children versus women. Where it gets a little interesting on the global front is, even if you have a more equal division of labor at home, like in some Scandinavian countries, it doesn't necessarily mean that there's a very high fertility rate. However, in Asian societies, for example, looking at Japan, South Korea, there is an even more unequal division of labor in the home, and we see the lowest fertility rates in the world. So we don't want to pretend like it has no effect. We think it really does. And you can also have these qualitative studies where you go talk to women in South Korea, Japan, and they really do feel like they're closed. Marriage does not feel like a great option for them. It feels like their life will... they'll lose a lot in a marriage because they will have so many more pressures on them than they already feel. And so, acknowledging how the time has shifted, acknowledging that there are these inequalities, we can certainly do that, but we also shouldn't pretend like they don't have an effect on people's attitudes towards family formation.
By the way, we've gotten quite a few people writing in talking about fears about climate change and overpopulation. And so I also want to bring in a caller, not necessarily on this topic, but Glenn from Bucks County is on the line. Glenn, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Yeah, my comment is America's always had an issue with population of workers. And the way we solved that was bringing in people from other lands, the immigrants, a.k.a. I'm from Canada. My dad and mom decided to move to America, brought their four children with them. And what did these four children do? They've married, they've had children, they've contributed to America, everything that has happened to this point. The problem is current people just want to run all these people out of here. They want them out. The infamous, you know, the Browning of America, the replacement theory. Come on, people, give me a hand. These are people here to help us, to help this country to grow from all these lands. That's what makes America great. Is because of what we've become and what we don't want to become at this point.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Glenn, from Bucks County.
So I do believe the research backs up, Glenn, that one of the sort of ironclad ways to boost population, if you're worried about the economic downstream effects, and also to boost the fertility rate, is through immigration, through migration. I believe in this country, non-Native Americans have a fertility rate of 2.19, which is above the replacement level, just barely. I guess, Delano, for you, why wouldn't that be a recommendation in the report if indeed the idea is to encourage fertility and population growth?
Mainly because it's not a sustainable recommendation, right? There are going to be people who want to have, you know, debates about how mass immigration just changes sort of the culture of a nation. I think those are legitimate. But on this particular issue, one of the things that is evident is that when immigrants come to this nation, they tend to be assimilated into the family culture of America. So the non-native born population may have a fertility rate of 2.1. My question would be, okay, what about their children and their grandchildren? Those generations are not having 4, 5, 6 kids as a general rule. So I don't think that this is a sustainable way. And then I also think all it does is it papers over what the issue is, right? Children in and of themselves embody a sense of hope for the future of their parents. And one of the callers mentioned climate change. And one of the things that we've seen is that the issues around climate change and the future of the country, the future of the world, are often listed as reasons why people don't want to have children. So this is largely a cultural issue. Last thing I'll say really quick is that there's been some research, qualitative studies, that show that women, there's a professor from Catholic University named Catherine Pokalik who wrote a book where she interviewed women in highly religious communities. And those women tend to have, you know, large families. And one of the things that they talk about is how their faith drives their desire to have a family. They see children as a blessing and not a burden, to the extent that the culture is becoming less religious and obviously more political and filling that hole with, I would argue, oftentimes partisan politics. I think that's one of the reasons that people are more pessimistic about the future and therefore having fewer children.
Yeah. Jennifer, real quick, can you just respond on immigration and what it does, what sort of the demographic impact of it? And I also note, I believe another way in which but fertility rates often go up is through restricting access to contraception. So the other side, maybe the political spectrum. But from what I've read, those are two ways in which you can change the trajectory of a country's fertility rate. Am I right, wrong there, Jennifer?
Love it. You're tossing me both immigration and contraception access. Is it like, here's a couple of softballs. These are no big deal. On the immigration piece, I think Delano makes some points are really grounded in evidence there that immigration is not going to be something, and demographers realized this decades ago. I know when I first started studying this issue in the early 2000s, there are reports from demographers looking out at the European population changes and saying, you know, you basically have to take in the population of Europe in order to prop it up. So, you know, if you're talking about, again, what is it we're trying to shift here? Is it just the number of people in a particular society? You just have to have a politically infeasible volume of people coming in for that. However, when we think about adapting to this world where we've seen these population shifts, lower fertility rates, slower growing or not growing at all populations, immigration is one of the things that is on the menu. And certainly you can cook your chicken a lot of different ways, right? So you can say, you know, we want to bring in people with these sets of skills, or we want to bring them in temporarily, or we want them to come in and form families here. There's so many different forms that that could take. It's on the menu for societies around the world, and each of them are sort of choosing a particular volume of it based on what they feel is right for them with their, with, you know, their broader economic and political systems. But it's not, it isn't going to solve everything if you're just concerned about the number of people. On contraception.
Real quick on that one.
We only have 15 seconds left. Yeah.
Oh, on contraception. Yeah. With that one, we certainly, if you took away the right to contraception, as we saw part of this happening in Hungary, you see maternal mortality rise, infant mortality rise. You can see, you know, really a tremendous fall in terms of well-being for women and for families. And so, you know, that's something that we'd want to be cautious to watch.
Thank you so much. Jennifer Shuba, President and CEO of the Population Reference Bureau. Jennifer, thanks so much for your time today on Studio 2.
Thank you.
And same to you, Delano Squires, Director of the Richard and Helen DeVos Center for Human Flourishing at the Heritage Foundation. Thank you, Delano.
Thank you.
And thank you so much to Marjorie, Noreen, Sarah, and Jordan for calling in. We're so sorry we couldn't get to your call. You look like you had some great comments. And thanks to everybody who wrote in. This really struck a nerve today. And I also have to say thank you to our producer, Debbie Builder, our producer, Andreas Copes, and Hazel May Bryan. Also to Mike Schiffler, our visual producer, and to Al Banks and Tina Calique, who engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCory. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We'll talk to you tomorrow.